Hello, bonjour, kwe, and welcome to the latest episode of At the Mic, au micro, a podcast brought to you by Arts Consultants Canada, l'Association des Consultants Canadiens en Art. Thank you so much also to all of our growing subscriber list. In this edition of At the Mic, we bring you an exceptional example of how Canadian architects are putting contemporary values into action today. Our guests are Bill Lett and Michael Gallant, registered architects with Unity Design Studio. Unity is a high-ranked B Corp architecture firm with over 50 years experience designing many arts and culture venues, including the remarkable new Canadian Canoe Museum. My name is Victoria Steele, and I'm chair of the board of Arts Consultants Canada, and I had the pleasure of being at the opening of this unique new museum in May of this year. So our guests today are the design team of the new Canadian Canoe Museum. Before we get into, I just have to say, I was fortunate enough to be at the opening of this museum in May. Wow. My reaction was, wow. So this was such a great opportunity to have a conversation with this talented group. About how they came to this point, how this whole museum came to be. It's actually not a brand new museum, but it's a brand new facility. And there's a whole story as to how it came to be. And this is the only Canadian Canoe Museum, or the only canoe museum in the world, too. So that has got a lot of attention. And I'm going to invite maybe Bill, or Michael, you two decide who wants to sort of talk about how this journey kind of came to be.
I'd love to start. if we look at the history of the museum, it started with Kirk Whipper at Camp Candelore, and he was given one canoe, and then that became 20 canoes, and then that became 100 canoes. And that collection sat in Haliburton for some time, and it was a wonderful place and still is a wonderful place. The camp still has the original museum building that they utilize. But there was a series of dedicated people who brought the collection to Peterborough. And part of that was the bankruptcy of the Outboard Marine Corporation, and this opportunity to have a large warehouse building available for the canoes to be stored, and then eventually for a museum to develop. And an enormous group of committed people really spent a lot of time thinking about what this museum could be. Because ultimately, you know, I think the waterways and the canoe tell the history of Canada the way, you know, the horse tells the history of the United States. And it's such a compelling history to speak through the canoe. And when people first start thinking about a canoe museum, they might say, why? But I think fundamentally that storytelling through the canoe is so compelling. And what the museum didn't have at the location that they had, which was a warehouse building, was water. And so through an entire process, the idea was that the museum would develop on Parks Canada land next to the lift locks in Peterborough. And as has been in the press over in the years at the start of the pandemic, it became clear that that site had some serious contamination issues, and those issues wouldn't and couldn't be dealt with in one time, that it would be an ongoing problem for the museum. And this all came about at the start of the pandemic. All cultural institutions, as you would know, Victoria, were concerned about what the pandemic would mean to them. And so the museum saw an opportunity to pivot. And it was, I think, fundamentally driven by the fact as well that they really wanted a campus that was on the water. And I think we'll probably talk about how fantastic it is that this is more than just a museum. But the pivot to look at new sites was a really important point in time, I think, for the museum. And it's where we got involved. And we were really looking at two things. We knew the museum. We had been involved in the previous competition for the museum. But we are local and we understood the community. And ultimately, with the federal and provincial grants, the museum had a time frame that they had to have this project complete by. So we were able to help them not only look at sites, but also think about process. And so looking at different contractual models through an integrated project delivery process, we basically have been able to deliver this museum in the same time frame as what was expected at the Liftlock site, but we had a year less to do it in. And so we're really proud that we were able to do that as well. But ultimately, the first thing we had to do was think about the sites.
Yeah, and I can chime in and add a bit to that, if that's okay. You know, I think Bill was kind of defining a framework of where the museum was at, and you have to feel for them that they had this successful campaign, they had funding from upper levels of government, they had excitement around the project from the community and across the country, and to come across this contamination on the site really jeopardized all of that. And so we were fortunate enough to be engaged with them on a discussion around what this would look like. Like Bill said, it required us to have a conversation around what procurement and construction types we might be able to use to help them through this, which ultimately we went integrated project delivery, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that. But one thing that I love about this project is that we had a unique opportunity to actually help them look at new sites. So often, you know, as an architect, clients will come, they have their program, they have their site, and they say, let's work together and make something beautiful here. And here we were walking all around the waterways in Peterborough with the client and with their board members and looking at sites that might be the right fit. And there's a site in Peterborough known as Johnson, the Johnson site. It is a municipally owned site. And ironically, as I've come to understand, the museum had looked at this site years ago, had always dreamed of this site, and the political climate, because it's municipal land, it was zoned open space, just never allowed for the stars to align to let this site come forward. But the circumstances in the pandemic meant that that this site had to be chosen, basically. The municipality had the option of supporting the museum and seeing it come to fruition or not. And fortunately, that site became available, and we were able to work with the city and the museum on securing that land as part of the project. I remember when we were touring around all the sites, the board chair at the time, Vicky Grant, was with us, and the Johnson site has this beautiful willow tree right on the waterline. And Vicky was standing there, and she turns to me and she goes, "We're done. This is it. This is the site." And obviously, there's all kinds of logistics, and we can talk about that if you want to, about, you know, floodplain and all these things. And there's some really kind of fascinating challenges that came about that had some history tied to them that allowed it to move forward. But that was the site that we selected. And then we moved in the integrated project delivery. We do this kind of intensive design exercise. It's 4 months long, and it's called validation. In this case, we did some really quick pre-validation to say, is this feasible? Can we actually physically build here? Obviously, there was the brokering of the land with the municipality, which wasn't an exercise in of itself, but given the floodplain, given the setback requirements along Ashburnham Drive, was there physically enough real estate to build this thing on the site? So we did some of that initial work, and then we assembled a team that included a builder and some key consultants and some key trade partners as well. And I'm sure Bill will talk about this a bit as it's more of his area of specialty. But we had a strong team around the table who ultimately said, we can build this building for this much money and this much time. And we dove into it. It was a really kind of exciting time. we're all working from home for the most part. I remember those days, Bill, as me sitting up in my spare bedroom, which is now my son's room, just, you know, slaving over drawings. It was an exciting time because we are members of this community. We wanted to see this thing happen. And there was honestly also just this energy behind it that nobody wanted to see the museum go down a path that would end with it not coming to fruition. And the momentum and the interest with everybody at the time was really kind of an exciting thing.
No pressure at all, too. The museum is actually at the end of the street that I live on. So walking the dog every day.
I had no idea, though I was honored to be able to be at the opening because like many Canadians, my family were huge fans of the canoe. I was aware of some of the challenge, but didn't realize some of the complexity of it. And that's just some of the physical issue. The other thing that really struck me was the design itself. And I wondered about the approach. And I'm thinking that the Canoe Museum has had for many years a national board council, but also a national Indigenous council. And the Indigenous presence isn't just there. It is the heart of much of this building. Maybe you can talk about the approach and how that influenced the design.
Sure. I'll start and maybe I'll let Michael go. Michael was the design architect, so this is his spotlight. But you know, what was in the pre-validation phase that Michael referred to, we had to understand all the work that had been done to date. And the National Council that you referred to, Victoria, the Indigenous Council, had done a lot of work. There had been a lot of programming work done. But fundamentally, I think the most important thing to understand, and this was the part that had to be accommodated, was, you know, usually when we think about design, we think about cost as one factor. We think about the size of the building as another factor, and then the fit and finish as the third factor. So if you think of a triangle, in the case of the museum, there was not a desire, but we were told that the entire collection had to be on the site of the museum. And so when you think about a large artifact museum, it's one thing if you're talking about smaller artifacts, and we've done collection storage facilities for, you know, 45,000 artifacts, but they're all very small. In this case, we have 600 artifacts that are all quite large, some of them over 50 feet long. And so that was a bit of a game changer for us, in that we knew we had to fit this entire collection under one roof. So when Michael started the pre-validation testing, that was really kind of a starting point. Maybe you want to talk about that, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, fitting the building on the site and the design evolution, I think, is something that we can definitely chat about. And I mean, I could ramble forever, Victoria, on this kind of stuff. I think the premise and the benefit of working with the Canadian Canoe Museum was that they did have this national council. And they had deep relationships with a lot of Indigenous communities across the country that were able to share their learning with us in kind of a rapid fire design exercise tied to the schedule that we had, some of the challenges. The Canoe Museum has just great representation and really good insight into these things. I'm thinking about some of the conversations that we had and some of the impacts of that engagement that informed the design. One of them is that it's a trilingual building. So we actually did all of the wayfinding and signage throughout the facility, but the prominent language, the first language, is Anishinaabemowin, which is the local Indigenous language. And that's the first language that you see on all signage throughout the building. And then English and French as well. And there's also Braille. So we also had a high level of accessibility in this building that we were able to integrate as well. I think other things that might not come to mind when you're thinking about how we might have incorporated Indigenous learning and understanding into the project is just the ability to have smudging throughout the facility. which you wouldn't see when you walk through, but that was something that was very important to the museum, having had those relationships. And it's something that was a challenge for the team. I know most museums and those in the conservation community might kind of be holding their breath to hear something like that, but it was very important to be able to do that. And that's something that we were able to accomplish in this building. I think too, the ability and the opportunity with this site was that it was on the water. The previous site was in a canal, and so there weren't opportunities to have docks and things like that. So when we did this pivot with them to look at the Johnson property, what an opportunity to have docks and actual canoes. The Canoe Museum has a fleet. So they have, this summer was their first summer of actual on-water programming. Bill and I were at the museum actually just this past week, and they took, a more robust artifact from the collection, and they actually put it in the water too, which is unique to the Canoe Museum that you don't often see things like that happen. So that was a real opportunity. The design really is focused on bringing people to the water. Between where the museum is sited and the water is the Trans-Canada Trail. And so there's a lot of activity at the back of the building, or arguably the front of the building, that really presents for the museum this whole new era of programming opportunities and how to engage people with the collection and what that means. I think in addition to that, there are really interesting gems that are unique to the Canoe Museum, one of which is that they have a workshop within the museum. They've always had that. At the previous museum, it was one of my favorite things to walk through and see craftspeople working on a restoration or a workshop on how to carve paddles. And so in this design, when you come into the space, the first thing you see is that workshop area is front and center. You can't avoid it. And Jeremy Ward, the curator, kind of romantically talks about the smell of the wood and, you know, all of those things that, are multi-sensory when you come into the building, related to canoe's history and culture that, connect you to what's there, which I think is a really interesting thing. And Bill, you were saying about trying to squeeze this building onto the site. So, you know, there's kind of this mathematical equation, I guess, that happens early in the design process when you add up all of the, you know, the functional program of a building. You've got over 600 canoes. They're all this size. They're going to consume this much real estate. You're going to have a lobby. You're going to have an events room. You're going to have this workshop. Obviously staff need some place to go, and you add up all of these spaces, and it turns out that on this particular site, the footprint of the building didn't really jive with what the functional program was. So in the previous design, it was this kind of sprawling museum that was this low-lying thing. And as a result of the constraints of this particular site, it almost had to be the opposite. We had to push the exhibits up to the second floor. And when you actually look at the footprint of the storage facility, we call it now the collection hall. So there's 100 canoes in the actual exhibit, but 500 or so are in the collection hall. And in a previous museum, those were all in a back building. And for most museums that have a collection this large, it's not uncommon to have that portion of the collection in a whole separate building altogether. So as a member of the public who's coming to visit, you don't often get the exposure to the entirety of the collection. And to Bill's point earlier, one of the interesting things about bringing everything under the roof was how impactful just the scale of that collection is. I remember the first time when we were kind of getting to learn about the museum's collection, Jeremy took us, the curator, into their back building. And it was just the scale of 500 canoes all sitting on racks in this big open space that takes your breath away. And so when we started to think about that tied to the design of this building, the footprint of the collection hall had to be tight, which meant that the racks had to go quite high. We had all intensive design sessions on how they actually would access them, make sure that they're safe from a curatorial standpoint, But it meant that our floor to floor is actually 7.6 meters, which is quite tall. It gave this even more pronounced presence to this part of the collection that most people don't often get to see. So as we started to look at the design, we talked about an opportunity really to showcase that. So as you come into the building, your first experience is with this workshop. Your second experience is a glass window into this collection hall to see these 500 canoes. We had to consider and to think about how we guide people from the lower level up to the second floor, which is now the exhibits hall. And it really presented an opportunity for a staircase that was more of like a procession. So you start in the lobby, you take in all of these things, the wood burning fireplace, which is also unique to a museum, but really critical in canoe culture. You move up to your first landing where you have this view down and into the collection hall. You come around this mass of the within the building that is the kind of main visual cue of circulation. And you have this dominant view down into the lobby that curves out towards the water. And then when you arrive at the top, you have a view out through the events room to the western exposure of Little Lake and the Otonabee River that then guides you into the exhibits hall. So, you know, Bill often talks about with constraint comes opportunity. In this case, we had a really tight footprint, but we were able to stack all the elements that really created this kind of dynamic and really rich space that allows visitors to the museum to be able to understand and experience the collection.
I think also, before you jump in, Victoria, I just want to say one thing. You know, Michael mentioned conservation. We had an incredible conservation consultant, Michael Harrington, on the project who we had worked with on past projects as well. And when we started to look at the canoe, the collection storage area and the height of it that Michael referred to, the rack, you know, we could take an entire podcast just to talk about the racking system itself. But it is such a sophisticated racking system. It had to be custom designed and it was manufactured here in Peterborough by a local steel trade. And it was incredible to be able to do this. And one of the things that has happened now is that other watercraft museums around the world are coming to see what the Canoe Museum has done in that collection storage space, because it is such a sophisticated racking system and it meets from a conservation standpoint, you can do so much with the system, and it really is interesting. So it's been for us, it's been great to be involved at a macro level, at the building level, but then at a micro level, thinking about how each artifact gets stored within that collection hall. So how often do you get to do that? What an incredible opportunity.
I'm so you know, fascinated by how some of this all sort of came together. As somebody who was more, you know, your outside Canadian citizen canoe lover, you know, coming into this space and just being wowed, and to think of the amount of detail that goes into it. I'd like to ask you a question about project management, because, you know, we think of architects as being creative and responding to clients and community, but it sounds like there was a huge project management sort of challenge and expertise that you have here. But before you answer it, I just, for people who are listening, okay, you talked about this conservation piece and the number of canoes. Remind us what the date of the earliest watercraft is in this museum.
Oh, goodness. I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. Do you, Michael?
Yeah, Michael, do you know? They're really old. I mean, this is what I want listeners to know. They're real. And you were talking about, you know, on the water, there was one of the earliest ones. There's some very, very, very old ones. And it's astounding. Sorry to put you on the spot. Do you know, Michael?
No, I don't. I mean, I don't know the actual date. I know that, you know, the bulk of the collection is indigenous in nature. When we met with Carolyn just this past week, she was talking about, you know, the fact that, even the more contemporary canoes are indigenous in their foundation, right? The structure and how it's constructed have indigenous roots. I know some of the oldest are likely dugout canoes, but whether they've actually been, cross-referenced back to when they were originally constructed, I don't know.
I have to say, as someone coming in and seeing this collection and how it was racked, and I obviously have to go back and spend more time there, because I felt like I was barely scratching the surface. And I want to say kudos to that sort of welcoming hall, because you're right about the fireplace. And it didn't strike me until you just mentioned this right now, how critical that fireplace is, as you say, in canoe culture. You've really, really embraced the indigenous roots of this is the beginning of Canada. It's like you said at the beginning, Bill. I have an enthusiasm about this.
It's great.
I talk to, like, say, have you been? You gotta go. Maybe we can go back to my question about the project management expertise and challenge, because it's pretty clear that this was, I didn't realize some of the time frame, and I just want to say kudos. Share some of your project management wisdom with us, please.
Well, this is a story about collaboration. Is how you project manage. This is not about an individual or an organization necessarily coming in and doing management. This is not about us as architects or prime consultants or whatever you want to call the design team managing the project. This is about a group of organizations and a group of people coming together as a team. And that is a fallout of the approach that we took through integrated project delivery. So we had a really committed group that Michael referred to earlier of designers, consultants, trade partners, builders. And so we all had a common goal, which was the museum. And so as a team, we were able to come together. And part of IPD, or integrated project delivery, is that we come together in what we call a big room. And everybody comes together at the start of the project. And in this case, we came together once a week, every week, for an entire day. And we had these discussions around the project. So the project starts to manage itself organically because of that collaboration. And the idea is, like, the racking system, we were looking at different ways of how we could build it, and everybody was chiming in, and even the mechanical contractor was saying, well, I could do this part of it in my shop, and someone else could do this part of it in their shop. So it was more about dialogue, which is so important, and that collaboration that really set this project apart. And I think so much of the success when you walk into that building and what you see is because of the collaboration and dialogue, and not necessarily the project management. The project management was just an outcome of the collaboration and the dialogue.
That's what makes these integrated project delivery projects so interesting, is the ability to get to the root of a problem or a challenge and have a team around you that supports finding solutions to those things. In a more traditional design bid build scenario, where an architect is the master architect and knows all things, which is never actually true, and designs this great piece of art, and then they put it out to tender, and then the trades and the builder there's a separation. There's like a line in the sand where the architect's done their work, there's a handing a baton, and then the construction team starts and has to interpret everything through drawings and specifications. And it really is just a missed opportunity, right? Some of the best things about this project are that we had everybody at the table in this contract model at the same time to solve these problems together. And it actually encourages our designers to see and hear and learn from tradespeople. And I think it encourages and motivates the trades as well to bring ideas and themselves to the table with a really strong result, because they've been part of this process. So the racking that Bill keeps mentioning is a classic example of what IPT can do, because it was a collective design execution at working directly with trades. And I think, you know, it's funny. I remember when we first started doing some IPD projects, it was kind of like architects have to brush off their ego a bit, right? Because you have to share the pot with everybody else and acknowledge the fact that there's really good ideas that come from other people, especially people that do this work on a day-to-day basis. You know, I can draw a really pretty picture, but I probably am not going to be very good at building it compared to, you know, the welder down the street who does this day in, day out. And I think too, it's kind of full circle about this is Bill's dad who started the practice. We have his hand drawings down in the basement, and we were talking about, you know, the Shaw Festival Theater as being, you know, a national museum that was built on 6 drawings. And the reality was he probably was on site with Ron Tom back in the day, actually pointing things out and working with trades, and go figure, full circle back to where we are now. That's what's really, I think, a big driver to what makes this museum as great as it was and able to be built in the time that it was. It's just that people were motivated and felt engaged with the process and the project.
There is one other aspect though, Victoria, that has to be said. And that is that Michael referred to Jeremy, who is the curatorial director. So the executive director and the curatorial director, Carolyn Hislop and Jeremy Ward, are the most dedicated people we have worked with, I think. They, in an IPD project, the owner group plays an enormously important role. And they have been at the table and gone over and above to support this project. And they have been supported by a board of directors that has been fantastic. We've had 2 board chairs, Vicky Grant and Kevin Malone, through this project, who have provided incredible leadership and governance and guidance. But on the day-to-day, Carolyn and Jeremy, this museum is such a success in huge part to them.
Yeah, what a rewarding process. And it sounds to me like through this, you might have even learned some kind of newer ways of working that you might bring into other projects that you're doing.
Yeah, so one of them, I guess, off the start was this National Indigenous Council that they have. And these relationships that the museum has really built over decades with the Indigenous community. And oftentimes, you know, when we're looking at new work or we're replying to RFPs, there are requests for proposals. There are questions around your experience with Indigenous engagement. And what I think I learned from this project, especially we're learning from Carolyn and Jeremy, as Bill mentioned, is that these are relationships. They don't start and finish with a particular project. When you're in a community, having the relationship with the local Indigenous communities is paramount. And I think one of the biggest things that we've learned from this project is that we've started to grow those roots a bit deeper here in Peterborough and in other communities where we're working. So it's not a transactional relationship. It's not a checkbox. It's more of an ongoing dialogue on how to improve our work. So that's one thing. I think too, what's really interesting on this project with integrated project delivery is how many of the trades were local as well. There was a lot of pride that came forward with the electrical team, with the mechanical team, with the drywaller who installed all the beautiful wood fence and everything through the main lobby, that this is someplace that they're gonna bring their family to and they're gonna visit on a regular basis. But they also likely weren't gonna be eligible in a more traditional contract to participate in something like this if it was bid in a more traditional model, where we were able to give them an opportunity working together on a bigger project than maybe what they otherwise would have had, and be able to build their portfolio and their skill sets with things that maybe aren't typical for this area or this region. So I think that's something that's really interesting. And Bill's doing some really good work now on how to do social procurement too on some of our work that allows, you know, the impact of these projects from an economic standpoint to resonate as well, be more than just the final built building.
I think maybe I'll jump in, Victoria, because I think this feeds really nicely into our values as a company. And we have been a values-led organization now for over a decade. And I think that it has really blossomed through the work that we've been doing in collaboration. And we chose to rebrand the company this year from Lead Architects to Unity Design Studio. And the reality is that we felt and feel that that our values are really about building for community and with community. And what that means is that usually our projects, we're bringing together a disparate group of stakeholders and we have to unify them into a common direction. So that's how the name change came about. But it was driven through the values that we have. The social procurement piece that Michael said is part of that, that social corporate responsibility. And it's been great working with organizations across the country on some of that and looking forward to doing more. But the other piece was we also decided 4 years ago that we wanted to talk the talk and walk the walk. And so we opened up our books and we had, we decided that we wanted to become B Corp certified. We wanted to become a company that had a third party review everything we do with our staff, with our clients, on our projects, in our own offices, everything. And so 3 and a bit years ago, 4 years ago now, really, we did become B Corp certified. And we've just gone through our B Corp recertification. And I'm pleased to say that we were able to increase our score by 8 points, which for people who understand what this means is it's a big deal to be able to say that we've improved on how we do things and what we do and how what we're doing for our staff and our projects. But we are currently, as we speak right now, at least, we are the highest scoring B Corp certified architecture firm in Canada. And we're one of the top five in the world. And this project exemplifies what it means to be a B Corp certified company. You know, to Michael's point about working with local trades and everything, we were able to bring all our values to the table and everything that we've learned. We believe firmly in continuous improvement and lessons learned, and we've got a lot coming out of this project as well. But I think that value proposition that we have helped feed into the project as well. And we're just, we're super proud of it.
As someone who is a certified management consultant who teaches cultural management at universities and so on, I've talked quite a bit about B Corp and what that is. And I have to say, I was so excited to see that you were certified and the conversation we had earlier about that commitment that you have. And I think what's really interesting about the B Corp process is that you just talked about the recertification, is that it is about walking the talk, right? And I think that there's a lot that can be learned by the rest of us in the cultural sector about, we talk a lot about values and putting them into action, right? That this is the bottom line. But then what it can mean to have the recognition of that and, frankly, the commitment to that that comes from being in the B Corp process. So I just want to say kudos to you guys. This is real leadership. And I know you mean it, every word that you say, genuinely, in terms of your values and commitment to community and all that. So I just want to say how inspired I am by the work that Unity is doing. And I hope that you have an opportunity, perhaps through this podcast and other opportunities, to share this learning and experience with others to inspire others. And maybe you just say a couple words about the B Corp process, because some people may not know it, Bill.
So B Corp is a not-for-profit organization itself that was established approximately a decade ago. It requires organizations. The first thing we had to do was actually change our bylaws to say that we wouldn't be a profit-driven organization, that there was more than profit that was important to us. So we had to involve lawyers to actually change our shareholder agreement and the bylaws that we have in place as an organization. And then that allowed us to start the B Corp certification process. Ultimately, it's a scoring system, like many different certifications. We have to open our books and show how we pay our employees, what we pay our employees, what we do with the community. We have to have policies around giving and philanthropy. There's quite a large environmental component. There's an extremely large community component, what we're doing in and out of the communities. In the case of consulting, it's what our projects are doing for the communities that they serve. So they look at the types of projects that we're doing, how we're actually doing that stakeholder engagement, that becomes part of it. And so there's over 250 questions that we answer. We then, once we've done that, we sit down with a representative who goes through a series of interviews with us and understands us a bit better. And then ultimately they go away and we get a score and it's published. And we can say that this is not just us saying that we do these things. This is someone else who has come in and audited us. And this is the result of that audit.
And I think it's terrific leadership. Think of the world that we live in today. Obviously, we're all concerned about environment. We're all concerned about healthy workplaces and all these other factors that you just referenced and relevance to community. So again, kudos to you. I thank you. You've inspired me. Now, just in closing, you must feel pretty good about the results of this canoe museum project. It's had lots of media coverage. It's had recognition, I hope, from colleagues, friends. And I was at the opening and I saw the reception. Obviously, it was packed of people, but a lot of recognition from politicians at all levels. It's very noteworthy. And I'm just wondering how you're feeling about this particular project right now that it's done and it's living.
You were in the room with us. The first event that was held at the museum was with a smaller group of supporters of the museum, the board, the council, and Michael and I were fortunate enough to be asked to be one of the first members of the project to get up in front of this group of people and speak. And I was blown away with the emotion. And the first thing I said was, I have to take a picture of all the lovely people that are in this room that made this project a reality. And so standing at the podium, I took a picture of everybody in the room. And I don't know if there are many other professions where you can go through a process that takes many years, that's a lot of hard work, but where the outcome can be so gratifying, where you're standing in a space that you've had such incredible involvement with, and then to have all the people standing in front of you that have made it a reality, it doesn't get better than that.
I agree with everything Bill said. I mean, I think the overwhelming emotion for me is just gratitude, right? Like to be able to do this kind of work with these kind of people and on a collection this significant is a gift. And so I think it's very humbling and energizing and all of those good things. And it's just heartwarming to see the reception that people have had and that the work that we've built together is resonating and influencing and impacting people. It's a really special thing.
No, I think you have a wonderful unity and in terms of the approach that you're taking to your work and your commitment to your values. And I'm inspired and really look forward to seeing what your team is up to in the future.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much.
And that wraps up this edition of At the Mic, Au Micro, a podcast of Arts Consultants Canada. For information on Arts Consultants Canada and our members, please check us out online at artsconsultants.ca. To send us feedback or questions or anything you hear in this podcast series, please email us at podcast@artsconsultants.ca. And you can check out our show notes in the podcast for links mentioned during the program. Thank you so much for joining us at the Mic. Remember to subscribe to this podcast on Arts Consultants Canada's YouTube channel, as well as Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Et notez bien que quelques épisodes sont en français. Until next time, thanks for listening. À la prochaine.